All right, we'll call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Johnson is kind enough to move the minutes of our last meeting. Is there discussion with respect to those minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion prevails. First up, we've got the chair's motion. Chair is going to show deference to our members, however. We've got, we'll come back to House File 512 regarding gift certificates. House File 933, Representative Tilbury is Vehicle Protection Product Act adopted. Representative Tilbury moves the file. House File 933 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. Representative Tilbury.
Yeah, and I just saw my testifier with me, Mr. Chair, and now he's left the room for a moment. But I'm sure he'll join me as soon as possible, and that would be Paul Cassidy. So that's like an all-call for Paul to get up here.
There he is. He's coming.
Well, this is House File 933, and this particular legislation clarifies how vehicle protection products sold with warranties will be treated in the marketplace. Examples of vehicle protection products include things like alarm systems, body parts, marking products such as glass etching, satellite tracking systems, and other similar anti-theft devices. This legislation provides that the warranters of these products will register with the state, demonstrate the financial ability to cover their warranty obligations, and provide disclaimers and claim procedure information in the warranty agreement. The financial responsibility requirements, disclosures, disclaimers will significantly protect consumers who purchase these products. These regulations are easy to administer and do not impose a significant burden on the businesses who provide vehicle protection products with warranties or on the regulatory agency that administers this process. Businesses like this, because if they're going to be having warranties along with, they'd like companies that are backing up their warranties. It just makes sense. Consumers usually come back to the companies rather than to the warranty place eventually if they're not backing their product. So that's why this is such a good bill. I have Paul Cassidy here. He's going to explain some more and give his testimony if possible, and we'd love your questions.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury. Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Paul Cassidy, the law firm of Leonard Street and Denner. I'm here today on behalf of the National Vehicle Protection Association in support of House File 933. The National Vehicle Protection Association is a trade association of manufacturers who produce and distribute automobile anti-theft products. Mr. Chairman, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation, there are over 204 million motor vehicles in the United States and 191 million drivers. That means there are more cars than people in this country at a time when vehicles are becoming increasingly more expensive. In many cases, automobiles are a family's most valuable asset. In Minnesota, over 14,000 motor vehicle thefts occurred in 2005, costing consumers tens of millions of dollars in loss claims. As a result, Mr. Chairman, anti-theft products are becoming increasingly popular with consumers. Examples of anti-theft products include identification systems such as body parts marking and window etching. Window etching, if you're not familiar with, is a product that auto dealers using an acid-based ink mark each of the windows on an automobile vehicle, and then they put a sticker in the window to warn people that the glass on the vehicle has been etched. It makes the car useless for auto thieves who, if they're going to take the car and market it after they've stolen it, they would have to replace all six windows. Other products include steering wheel locks like the club, which you see on TV quite often, alarm systems, ignition disablers, and satellite or radio tracking systems. Automobile anti-theft products have a proven track record in deterring theft and recovering vehicles in this country. For example, American Family Insurance Company reported that etched vehicles had a theft claim frequency 43% lower than that of vehicles without etching. National Car Rental Company reported that theft frequency declined 85% after their Cleveland fleet was marked. The Chicago fleet experienced a 30% increase in recovery rate after marking. The facts speak for themselves. Amateur and professional thieves alike simply move on if they know a car is protected by one of these products. I would also like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that Minnesota Statutes Chapter 65B actually recognizes the value of anti-theft product devices and mandates a 5% premium reduction for certain devices. The products covered by the proposed legislation are anti-theft products with warranties that typically provide up to $5,000 in warranty coverage in the event the product fails to prevent your car from being stolen. The products deter the theft of vehicles, assist in their recovery if stolen, and in the case of product failure, the product warranty protects consumers from the losses associated with the theft to the extent that the consumer's loss exceeds the vehicle's insurance coverage. The bill's purpose is to offer consumers a viable market of vehicle protection products with an appropriate level of mandated consumer protections or product disclosures at the time of sale and a solid level of financial viability. To protect consumers by requiring all manufacturers and distributors of vehicle protection products to acquire and maintain a warranty liability reimbursement insurance policy or to have a minimum net worth of $50 million to make sure the warrantors are financially able to pay their claims. And finally, the bill provides auto dealers with the assurance that they're selling a viable product to their customers backed by a company with the financial viability to stand behind their warranty and pay the claims in the event of a loss. The National Vehicle Protection Model Act has now been adopted in 16 states across the country, including Wisconsin, Massachusetts, California, Florida, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Tennessee, and Texas. House File 933 attempts to establish certainty in the market, Mr. Chairman, for auto consumers and auto dealers alike concerning treatment of anti-theft products and to protect consumers from warrantors whose financial condition might not be sufficiently sound to make good on their product's warranty when it comes time to pay a claim. The bill creates a very simple compliance structure. Product warrantors simply register with the Commerce Department and demonstrate financial responsibility for the use of a reimbursement insurance policy or net worth demonstrating a net worth of $50 million or more. Vehicle protection products are commonly sold with warranties that make claims to the consumer about the performance of the product. The warranties are not sold separately or apart from the sale of a vehicle protection product. This bill establishes specific recognition in Minnesota statutes for theft deterrent products sold with warranties. Many manufacturers offer consumers a warranty with a product that provides assistance with costs associated with the theft of their vehicle. Examples of these costs include reimbursement for the insurance policy deductible, assistance with renting a replacement vehicle, the license fees and state sales tax for the replacement vehicle, and other costs not covered by insurance. Receiving a money-back guarantee or replacement of a theft deterrent product hardly assists a consumer who has had their auto stolen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. You must be aware of significant opposition if you went on that long about this bill. Is there significant opposition that desires to be heard with respect to this? Seeing none, are there questions or concerns from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Kilberry renews his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Same sign. Seeing none, that bill passes. Representative Kilberry, thank you very much. Next up is Representative Nelson. Chair moves House File 554. This is the Employee Free Choice Act. Recommended to pass. Representative Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Gotten kind of off my beat here a little bit.
Don't move it so quick. We do that sometimes, Representative Nelson.
Anyway, the House File 554 is the resolution to send to Congress and the President to passed the Free Choice, Employee Free Choice Act. And what the Free Choice Act is about, it's about allowing union members, our employees, to, without having to go through an election process, being able to choose a union, and by signing authorization cards, moving forward, and when they get enough cards, the employer then bargains with them and gives them the opportunity to get to a contract faster without the delays that are currently going on in the process. And that's the long and the short of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Zellich.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and no offense to Representative Nelson or his testifiers, but since this is a resolution, you just want to vote her up and get it out. We know the numbers here. We know what's going to happen with this and actually go on to the bills that are going to do something.
Well, I was thinking of weighing this one very carefully, but
yeah.
Representative Nelson, you heard the comment from the lead on the minority side. Are you good with that?
I'm good with that.
All right. Any questions, concerns, anyone else that desires to be absolutely heard on this bill?
Good bill.
Seeing none, Representative Nelson renews his, the chair renews his motion that House File 933 be recommended to pass and, I'm sorry, 554 be recommended pass and referred to the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
No. That motion carries. Representative Nelson,
thank you, Mr. Lato.
You were very articulate today. Next up is House File 1022, Representative Knuth's bill on rental vehicle no-fault auto insurance coverage is regulated. Representative Knuth moves that House File 1022 be passed and referred to the general register. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I'm going to speak quite as quickly as you. Basically, this is a pretty straightforward bill, and it comes out of being in touch with the person who spends a part of each winter in Arizona and realized after a number of years of renting a car for longer than one month that he was driving around without insurance coverage and was luckily not in an accident, but an upstanding citizen and therefore worried about driving around without insurance. And under current Minnesota law, a rental car is covered under the renter's insurance if renter's own auto insurance, if that insurance was bought in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't count under certain circumstances in one of them being if the car is rented longer than 1 month. So what this bill does would increase the definition, increase the length of time that a car is considered rented, so it would increase it from 1 month to 2 months. And in addition, a notification to the consumer when they're renting the vehicle, letting them know they don't have to do the checkup on the rental contract for the extra insurance, stating that if the insurance policy was issued in Minnesota, it must cover the rental of the vehicle. And we're adding to that just so people don't get caught in law they don't know about, notifying the consumer that there are time constraints to this particular provision of auto insurance covering the rental car. And members, you have in your packets an email. He's in Arizona at the moment, so he can't be here to testify. An email from the person I've been in touch with who precipitated this, and also a letter from Enterprise Rent-A-Car stating they've run into some issues surrounding this and they're supportive of this bill. There's some not quite opposition in the previous testimony, previous hearing, saying that the insurance federation or insurance companies may have some problems with it because a relatively small number of people use the insurance covering rental cars, but it could raise rates for everyone by a minuscule amount. And I think actually in some ways rental car companies have figured out how to get around this law. Consumers who don't know about the law can get caught in it. You can just re-rent the car every 30 days if you know about the law. And so they're actually giving insurance companies the same amount of risk without the insurance companies necessarily knowing about it. And so this is just a way to make sure people aren't caught without insurance and to make sure our rental car companies aren't paying a whole bunch of claims that they didn't necessarily know they would have to.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Is there anyone that desires to be heard with respect to this item? Questions for members of the committee? Representative Paulson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, I'm just curious, you know, why 2 months? Why? What do other states do? 1 month, 2 months? I mean, why not a year?
And Representative Knuth.
Well, it is a somewhat arbitrary number, the 30 days, the 60 days, and looking at it, a year, it would we'd be looking at a lease in that instance, and we don't want to be using this for people who would be leasing a vehicle, and so it's a compromise in between those two extremes, that, you know, renting it for people who are renting it for a certain amount of time, and then differentiating that from a lease, which would be a longer time.
Do you have any idea what, I don't know, do other states...
I'm not sure what happens in all the other states. I can't answer that question. I think in Minnesota, this was when it came into law was argued significantly, and I'm just basically trying to help consumers not get caught in a law that they don't know about. And actually, you know, there's some people who, this particular person, when I was talking to him about it, I actually called his insurance agent, and the insurance agent didn't really know the law offhand, so had to go back and look at it. So it's a way to make sure people aren't caught in the system.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not overly objectionable. I'm just curious. I mean, I'm guessing Minnesota's probably already generous with the month, but I'm not sure. I'll check before the bill goes to the floor. I'm just guessing. There's always just a little bit of creep that might add to insurance rates. I'm just
And to that, I mean, I think when we're talking about increasing insurance rates, the insurance companies, if someone knows about this law, if they're really wanting to rent a car for 3 or 6 or however many months, they can simply re-rent it every 30 days. And the insurance company is writing their insurance premium based on those 30 days. And so if you are a consumer and you know in car insurance laws in and out, then you can get around it, so to speak. So I think there are some arguments that insurance companies are better able to look at some of the risk involved with this as well.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith. Is this a widespread problem? I mean, are we legislating for the few or the many? I mean, other than the email that we've gotten here, is this a widespread problem?
Well, there's also
problem?
The...
Representative
Canoe. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, there's also rental car companies that have run into issues with this, and you know they don't want to be having their customers going without insurance on the rental cars. And so I think the letter from Enterprise Rent-A-Car shows us that they have run into this issue before, and they do exactly what I said. They simply re-rent the car every 30 days, but they would rather not have to do that if you're running into some issues with that and it doesn't quite happen, they want to make sure they're covered.
Representative Sellers, anything else?
Yeah, I mean, what I was looking for, I guess, maybe was more of a number. I mean, do we have 1,000 of these rentals a year, 10, 100,000, so that, you know, I'm with Representative Paulson. I'm not objectionable. I just, you know, we add a little bit more here and there, and pretty soon we've got a real thick book of laws. And I think the behind Representative Atkins over there, Chairman Atkins, there's quite a bit. So I don't want to put a bunch of new code in just for a couple of folks that, you know, found a problem, albeit a could be potentially bad one. I don't know if this necessarily rises to that occasion.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, we're not really putting new code into law. We're not creating a bunch of new legislation. We're tweaking it a little bit, and I think in particular when you look at adding language to the notification that our consumers get when they rent a car so that they do know there is a time limit, I think that is a pretty important thing for our consumers to know that they're not just getting part of the law in that notification, they're getting the whole law. And so I think that is a significant part of this bill.
Representative Zellers, anything further?
No.
Representative Knuth, in the testimony at the division, did they indicate what the increase, and you said minuscule amount to some folks,
I'm,
that
I'm,
might
I'm
be
quoting
hours.
Directly minuscule from that.
Okay.
From that.
So that was their
term. That was the insurance, the Insurance Federation's direct quote, yes.
Okay. Any other comments or questions from members of the committee? Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Knuth, for bringing this forth. I just have one question for you. Does this pertain to policies that are written in Minnesota or someone who rents in Minnesota? Someone who rents in Minnesota would be coming from Florida, renting a car here, or does it pertain to a Minnesota resident who goes down to Phoenix and rents there?
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burns, it pertains to policies written in Minnesota. And so as we have increasing populations in Minnesota, we do have people spending time in other places in other states, and it pertains to that. We can't regulate what other states put in their rental contracts, so of course we can't inform Minnesotans all over. And doing this, you know, I haven't been able to rent cars for that long, but just a few times, I didn't know that actually when I rented a car, I didn't need to check it off as a Minnesotan. And so it's again, if they know, they can do this. But to simply answer your questions, it's policies written in Minnesota.
Okay. So we get the notice we can only control happens in Minnesota. We're not able to notify Minnesotans out of state.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burns. Yeah.
Anything further? Anything further for members of the committee? If not, Representative Knuth renews her motion to pass House File 1022 and send it on to the General Register. Any other comments, questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Representative Knuth, congratulations. That motion passes. Bill passes. Next up, we've got Representative Simon with our most fascinating bill on the calendar today, House File 1441, Limited Purpose Trust Companies, Non-Substantive Term Changes Provided. Representative Simon, I would be most pleased to move House File 1441 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Recommended, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little nervous. This is my re-election bill. So
we figure.
Forgive me. Mr. Chair, I would actually, I'm wondering if the Chair would entertain possibly even placing this on the consent calendar. I understand it's that non-controversial, but I leave that up to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zellers, do you see any aversion to placing it on the consent? I know you'd love to discuss it on the floor as well.
I was just going to ask Representative Simon if you'd yield for a series of questions on this bill, but I don't, Mr. Chairman. I would.
Let me hear the bill.
Yeah,
I thought you guys had read it from cover to cover. Why don't we do this, Representative Simon? Present your bill,
sure.
And
yeah.
Then we'll look to our friends in the minority and make a decision on perhaps setting it on the consent calendar. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That sounds very fair to me. This is basically just a substitution of language and definitions. And this is a State Bar Association bill. It was thoroughly vetted, went through the committees. I think it was the business law session. Lloyd Grooms, representing the State Bar Association, is shuttling back and forth between committees and warned me that he might not be able to make it right here precisely. But I'm glad, Mr. Chair, that you don't have the hearsay rule here in your committee so I can represent what he said to me, which is that it's just a simple definition change. That's it. It's out with the old, in with the new terms for the same thing. It's just freshening the terms that are used as a matter of course. I don't practice law in this area, but I'm told that this just substitutes the old terms for the new terms for the same thing.
Can I suggest that we do this, and Representative Simon, Representative Zellers, is that we'll move it to the consent calendar. If in the meantime anything comes up that disturbs you folks and you want to get it on the General Register, I'm sure that the author and the chair would be more than willing to accommodate that so that you could have a vast discussion on the floor of the non-substantive changes to the limited purpose trust companies. But with that, I'll amend my motion then to send it to the consent calendar. Representative Paulson, do you have a comment or question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, is there anything in the bill that would lower attorney fees?
Representative Simon?
Not that I know of, and that would give me pause, Representative.
Yeah, then we would have an issue.
Yeah. I think I have an author's amendment.
All right, folks. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1441 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the consent calendar. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, motion prevails. Bill passes. Thank you, Representative Simon. Next up, we will do House File 512, which is the gift card bill. Representative Lilly will chair this portion of the meeting.
Mr. Chairman. As the chair makes his way towards the table, I'd like to compliment our page staff on the reorganization and organization processes from today. I understand that the cool plastic sheets were stolen by those scofflaws in the tax committee, but appreciate the organization from our house pages.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. It does show great creativity. I think it's pretty neat myself. I thought it works very well, so... Whoever's responsible, hats off to you. Chair Atkins, you have your bill before us. Not quite yet, but do you want to move your...
House File 512 be recommended pass and referred to the General Register.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is there any amendments to your bill, sir?
There is, Your Honor. The
Honor? Wait a minute.
He's as honorable as we get. The A4 amendment is my amendment. It'll clean up, and I'd be happy to explain it once we put it on, but it will just shape the bill up into the shape that I'd like to proceed with it, and I'd move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment as offered by Chair Atkins, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We have... House File 512 in front of us as amendment. Go ahead, Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What This is the gift card bill. In previous settings, I have taken out a gift card, had my scissors with me, and said this is what happens to gift cards. They either expire or they have they lose their value based on these dormancy fees that sometimes will kick in as soon as 6 months after the gift card is issued. Unfortunately, I chopped up one of my credit cards the last time I did that by accident, so I'm not doing that parlor trick anymore. But what the bill does, in essence, is a couple main things. It says that you cannot have expiration dates on gift cards, number one, and it says that you can't have fees on gift cards, number two. This is the gift that that can either keep on giving, which is the way it's represented, or it's the gift that can keep on taking with the various dormancy fees and service fees and all of that. In one instance, I'll tell one story, and then I'll stand for questions, or there may be some testimony. There was a young person that the card was purchased over the Thanksgiving holiday, given over the Christmas Hanukkah holiday, and by the time they went to use it over spring break, it was completely gone. It had expired, and that's unfair to the consumer. It's a it is the single largest gift that is now given in the United States. And the it just makes sense that it ought to hold its value. I thought for a while, and you'll notice I told you I'd explain the amendment. At one point, I did do expiration dates that would say that you have to have at least a two-year expiration date. The problem with that is that if we do that, under the tax code, what happens after 2 years, and I'm looking to my friends on the tax committee, is, and the reason I did that is because I thought, well, this is a liability that'll linger with you forever. Small business, you go, you try to get a credit, you try to get a loan, you do these things, and you're going to have this liability that's going to haunt you forever. But what I found out, actually from my friends in the Minnesota Retailer Association, is that after 2 years, it's actually then treated as an asset, so it balances out your books, and you don't have that creditworthiness issue, you don't have this ongoing liability. But what was an unintended potential consequence of a two-year expiration date, if we do that, then there's this windfall of money. Suddenly you've got an asset now on their books, and my counterpart in the Senate was talking about escheatment, which means that that money then would come into the state, and I didn't want to get into escheatment issues, and I think you'll hear from my retailer friends, they don't want to go there either. It's cleaner, simpler, and more straightforward to do it without an expiration date and without these fees. With that, there are a couple concerns that have been raised for me that I intend to continue to address. Number one is, and again, the focus has been on the dormancy fees and on the expiration date. There's two other elements to the bill. One is that that they can be sent in to pay your debts. So literally, you know, Target, Best Buy, some retailer could get an envelope with little gift cards in them, and you're supposed to apply that to the debt. And I'm getting my head around that. I can see where that could potentially be problematic. There's also the $5, you know, if it gets to be less than $5, they got to issue it back to you in $3.26. But I'm aware of some entities that issue $5 gift cards, you know, for school fundraisers and things like that. I'm not looking to bash that. So I'm still working on those issues, and I would like your deference, if I might, to continue working with some of the folks that are impacted between now and the next committee, as well as with Senator Steven, who's proceeding with this in the Senate, and see if we can't keep working at that as well. And with that, I just appreciate your support. I'd be happy to stand for questions. I think there are one or two people that might desire to be heard with respect to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Is there any questions for the author before we... is there anybody... any audience that'd like to testify for or against this bill? Oh, sorry. Okay. Representative Simpson, did you have a question? I'm sorry.
I do, but if you have testifiers first, I'll wait.
I didn't see anybody moving, so I still don't. So go ahead, Representative Simpson. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, I guess I appreciate the fact that you've done a lot of work on this and cleaned it up. As a retailer, there were some things in it that I wasn't too enthused about, and I'm glad to hear that you're still looking at the balance, the $5 balance, because I still, as a small retailer, that still gives me fits in our operation. And you know, at Christmas time, I'll have a school teacher come in and she'll buy 25 $5 gift certificates, and so I'm a little concerned about that. So if there's anything you can do for line 212 and 213, I'd appreciate it. I would certainly be willing to do a friendly amendment if you would like, but I guess I think I can take you at your word that you probably will help us get through that. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, I am going to keep plugging away. Actually, that, quite honestly, it just hadn't raised to the level of, we've been focused on some other elements, and I just haven't given it enough work yet. But I've gotten a lot of help from folks in the industry as well as consumers, including a couple of teachers that said, well, is this going to exactly the issue that you raised?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to keep plugging away. It will come to the floor. I look forward to, if we haven't figured it out, I'm sure you'll help me with it.
Well, Representative Simpson?
To that point, I appreciate your effort, and I certainly will have that amendment ready at the floor if we have to do it, but I would hope it goes away, because I do think it's pragmatic, and I don't think that it is really what you were after when you started after this. I don't think that's the issue you were looking at.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simpson, we really were after you and the school teachers. That's your right. That was not the target market.
Okay, Chair Atkins, we have... Representative Paulson has a question.
Yeah, there's no testifiers, Mr. Chair. Is it?
I looked around. If you start walking forward, if
Mr. Chair, what I may have with my comments, not necessarily allayed their concern, but voiced the concern, and I think I've indicated a willingness to continue to work with them on the issues that I raised.
Representative Paulson, is that?
Mr. Chair and members of the Senate, you identified the two issues I had concerns about, and I understand the bill is going to go right to the floor. I mean, and again, no disrespect to you, but I'm going to move to delete Subdivision 5 of the bill. And that's the portion that talks about applying gift cards to pay off credit card debt. The issue I have with that, when I think of retailers like Target, Best Buy, some of the retailers you mentioned in credit card systems, I think of people buying a gift card. You mentioned how it's the largest gift right now that's given. People are giving that, you know, gift so they can take it to a retailer and buy something with it. And I think it's going to put a tremendous burden on retailers, potentially, at least the larger ones that have pretty big operations and technology, and can make it pretty difficult to say, I'm going to apply this gift card to my credit card debt. I mean, I'm not sure how that would work, but I, you know, working in the technology area, I assume it's going to, there are going to be some costs with that. So, I'm just going to move just to delete that subdivision, and, you know, so the bill's going right to the floor, and maybe you'll...
Representative Paulson has offered an amendment. Is there any discussion to this amendment? Chair Atkins?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, I appreciate your concern about it. I just like the opportunity. This may not be the perfect language, but we might still be able to work within the context of this language. And I just started today, quite honestly, working with a representative from Best Buy who knows the issue very well, literally like 7 hours ago. And what I'd like to do is have a chance to visit with her, Senator Sieben, and those others. And then, to the extent that you, if it remains exactly the same and you're still concerned, I would anticipate that you and Representative Simpson would offer up the same amendment on the floor. But I'd sure like to get at least a shot to work at it between now and when we get to the floor and with the senator that originally drafted this language. And that's all I'm asking. So I guess, with all due respect, I'd recommend an opposition, and I'd appreciate a no vote. But I will keep working at it.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And, I mean, I'll still offer the amendment because you can obviously still work on the issue going forward on the floor anyway, and so I hope you will continue to do that regardless. So.
Okay, so thank you, Chair Paulson, and her chair, sorry. Back, a little flashback. Okay, so anyways, any further discussion to the amendment offered by Representative Paulson? Okay, so... those in favor of the amendment as offered, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion or amendment does not prevail. Any other, Representative Paulson? Okay. Thank you. Representative Zellers has a question.
Sure. And Chairman Atkins. And because I think you're just carrying the language from one of those senators, mine is more of a bigger philosophical, not necessarily for the retailers, but if this is such a problem with these expiration dates, then why not just give cash instead of making these folks in the retail industry hold these cards or that move the dates or eliminate the dates? Why not just give, getting a check from Aunt Ginny or Aunt Edith, like in my case, and hold on to your check or hold on to that $20 in your sock. Why make these folks do the savings and loan bank of Target, Best Buy, Circuit City, you name it?
Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, the, because I look like a big enough schmuck when I give a gift card to my wife. I think I'd look even worse if I gave cash. And if you want, I mean, we could do an amendment to do away with gift cards, but I don't think that's what you want either. And most, I think many folks are already moving this direction towards the no expiration dates, no fees. This just moves them along a little quicker, and I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We don't want him looking like a schmuck, so that's good.
Well, he takes care of that on his own. and Mr. Chair, like that's actually my question. I just wanted to know what you looked like when you gave her that riding lawnmower.
Mr. Chair, I did give her a mountain bike once. That was too big, and I ride it now.
Oh, darn, right?
I should like to renew my motion.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't paying attention. I didn't realize this was going straight to the floor either. So I am very concerned about this cash balance thing. So I think that at this point I would really ask that you consider taking that out of there as a friendly amendment, because it is very problematic in the small business community. I know it's not with the big holder of cards, the people that have the ability to trace these cards and stuff, but for us small-time operators, for the small stores, the guy that is trying to just get by, this, I'd really like to see that out of there. So I guess I would have to offer that as an amendment to take line 212 and 213 out of there.
Okay, so Representative Simpson has offered an amendment, oral amendment. Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, I am considering it. I'm just not willing to do it quite yet today. The focus has been on some other stuff. I'm very cognizant of the issue, as I noted before, and I suspect that if we haven't shaped it up in the way that you'd hope, that there will be that amendment on the floor. But I give you my word, I'm going to work at it and work with the senator. It'd be nice to have language that does not need to go to the conference committee, but to figure it out before we get to the floor. So with that, again, I'd urge a no vote, though I have the greatest regard and respect for the author and the amendment.
Representative Simpson?
At this time, I'll pull the amendment then.
Thank you very much. We almost had a testifier, so we don't. Chair Atkins, final word?
I appreciate your support.
Okay, so Chair Atkins renews his motion that House File 512, as amended, be passed and goes on to the General Register. Is that right? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Your 512 is on the way to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We're kind of, I think, I don't... Chair Atkins, it's really up to you as chair. What do you... Representative Junkie's coming...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy. We always give deference in this committee to non-members, and when Representative, what I'd suggest, Mr. Chair, that we do is take up the next House file with regard to the good faith bill, and as soon as we can certainly interrupt if Representative Junkie joins us.
Here he comes.
Speaking of Representative Junkie, why don't we take up his bill as long as he's here, and then we'll move on to the good faith bill after that.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Atkins. Representative Junkie, we're here on board, so.
Next up, folks, is House File 1300, Representative Junkie's bill on fuel terminals, weekly inventory reports required. Chair will move that House File 1300 be passed and re-referred to the General Register. Is that right, Representative Junkie? Going nowhere else?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair. And I also have an author's delete everything amendment.
I will move the delete all. It's entitled the AO7-0206. Any discussion with respect to that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
That passes. Motion prevails. Representative Junkie, bill's now in the position that you'd like to move forward with it. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be here at the Commerce Committee. I haven't had a place at this table since 1997-98, but I did serve on this committee at one time, and I miss it. You ready to vote now? Is that all I need?
Good enough. All in favor? No.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, members, this is a just asking for a little help down at our terminals. Particularly, the reason I'm carrying the bill, as you read through it, you'll see it does pertain to biofuels, and the Department of Agriculture is listed in here. And we've had we're trying to get a little supply line issues straightened out. And rather than talk any further, I have Bob Krogman here from the Retail Service Station Association, and Jerry Schoenfeld, former representative from the Minnesota Soybean Growers, who can address it much more succinctly and quickly than I can.
Thank you, Representative Junkie. Mr. Krogman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. The delete all, I think the easiest way to explain it is to look at it and go through a little bit. The first section where it says a person who operates a terminal shall notify if any of those products are physically not available means that a jobber, a cooperative, a licensed distributor going into those cannot pick up the product. They would notify the director of weights and measures that it just couldn't be blended, for example, in the case of ethanol or biodiesel. The second section says that the director of the weights and measures, which would enforce the mandate sections, and their misdemeanors under this, could waive a penalty if a licensed distributor could not get the product at a terminal. For example, last year, October, end of October, first part of November, one of the pumps at one of the terminals that was used to blend the biodiesel went down. You couldn't blend it for about a day. Those folks pulling a load of diesel fuel to haul to a farm or whatever could have been guilty of a misdemeanor for not having the biodiesel in there. This simply says if you can't get it at the terminal, the penalty may be waived. The 20 to 30 days is so that someone could not utilize this to their degree. If a terminal never had biodiesel, they couldn't claim non-availability. I think that explains it. I'd answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Krogman. Why don't we take all the testimony before we look for questions? There's another handsome fellow next to you there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I do work with Minnesota Soybean Growers, and for some of you who have been around here for a few years, know the battles we went through to get through the B2 mandate. The reason I'm here is because we've been working with Mr. Krogman to try and deal with this situation where there's a very temporary outage so that his people are not penalized in that situation. And we were the ones that have asked to have the 20 of 30 days included so that it couldn't be set up where it could be used as a way to use a loophole to get around the mandate. So we feel comfortable that this is workable from our standpoint as well, and the mandate stays intact.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Is there anyone else that desires to testify with respect to this bill? Questions or concerns for Mr. Krogman, Mr. Schoenfeld, or for the author? Yes, miss. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Diane Koblen with Flint Hills Resources. We're a large refiner on Highway 52 on the way to Rochester. I just wanted to just clarify that we do not have any problem with Section 2. I just wanted to, for the record, let everybody know that we already voluntarily do this. We already voluntarily notify the agency if we are ever having any supply disruptions, and we did not have any last year. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Koblen. That unsolicited pitch on behalf of our friends at Flint Hills. Is there anyone else that would like to advertise on behalf of their company and their wonderful practices? This is the Commerce and Labor Committee, by the way. So, any other questions or comments, or anyone else that desires to be heard with respect to this item? If not, the chair will renew his motion that House File 1300 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. Seeing no further comments, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Folks, that leaves House File 1251. I'll move House File 1251 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance, and that is my bill. So, recommended. Representative Lilly, welcome back to the chair.
Mr. Chair, we're telling you funny things here. Mm-hmm. Helps you organize.
Welcome back, Chair Atkins. Your bill is before us.
Mr. Chair, there is an author's amendment that is coming around. Perhaps I do want to have people get a chance to see the author's amendment, which will shape it up into the... what I've tried to do is take into account some of the comments that I've heard about this bill as it's traveled from one committee to the next, and this bill will still have to make one more stop in the... it's going to the Finance Committee, I believe, from there. It'll go to Energy. There's a small fiscal element to it. But in terms of what the bill does, this is good faith and direct action. What good faith means, and by the way, it's a widely bipartisan bill, and it has been adopted in 46 different states across the nation. It just says that if you're, when you're settling claims, when you're handling claims, that you cannot unreasonably delay or deny the claim. You can still reasonably delay. If you have to do investigation, if you have to do more work, you can still reasonably deny the claim. If somebody's presenting a fraudulent claim or whatever, it's still completely appropriate within the rules and within the law, even if this passes, to reasonably delay or deny a claim. Now, that said, folks, there's some real horror stories out there. There's a homeowner in Mendota Heights that testified the other day about having gone through months and months and months of delays and denies, and he had a very legitimate claim. It happens a lot with regard to mold claims. It happens in other instances as well. And this isn't, by the way, 95% of the time, whatever the, I'm sure most of the time, adjusters do a great job. They're good people. They work hard. They're handling claims. They're moving things along. This gets at the bad apple, the one that gives all of the insurers the black eye, that screws around, denies, delays, just for the sake of delaying and denying without any reasonable basis for doing so. If they do that, this gives the consumer an opportunity to have a remedy for that. This is simply a private cause of action. The second part of this is a direct liability. It says that when you sue somebody, you can name their insurance company. Frankly, folks, the insurance company's calling all the shots anyway. So if I'm suing Representative Zellers because he ran into my car or something, I sue Representative Zellers. It looks like I'm going after my friend Kurt Zellers, when in fact it's whichever insurance company that's calling all the shots anyway. Let's be truthful about what's really going on. Where it really becomes an issue is if Representative Zellers is my son or my father. How's that for scary? But it's a mom or a husband, wife, and there's really, at the heart of it, there's an insurance dispute. But it makes it look like mom is suing kid, or kid suing mom, or dad, or grandpa. You'll get these, you know, they try to make it out to be like there's this warring family that can't get along, when in fact all it is an insurance dispute. Let's call it what it is, folks. It's an insurance dispute. Tell jurors what they, then they don't go back to the jury room and they say, well, what's really going on here? You know, why does he hate his mom so much? Those are the two components. This, Mr. Chair, is my author's amendment. It's the AO70225X. And what I've tried to do is take into account what folks have raised. I would move that amendment. It'll shape it up into the position that I'd like to proceed with it, and then I'll explain the amendment briefly as well.
Okay. Chair Atkins has moved his amendment. Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment... is adopted, and so we have
and I'll explain it briefly, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
Go ahead, Chair Atkins.
It just came out today. What I was trying to do is be accommodating to all of the various concerns, just like the gift card bill. I've been hearing different comments and so forth. The first item, line 1.5, is other claims preserved. This does for all entities what happened. I don't know how many of you were on this committee last time. We had the Camacho decision that came out that said if a builder dissolved, and their insurance company was still there, you couldn't get at their insurance. And what this allows for, and what we did last year, was we allowed, even if the builder's gone, sometimes intentionally, I might add,
to try to foil the possible claim, it still allowed you to get the insurance coverage that was purchased and paid for and ought to be available to the homeowner that's trying to deal with their mold claim or whatever. This would extend that to all claims. If there's still an insurance policy that was out there, even if the company dissolved, you can still get after the insurance that was paid for. Secondly, 1.9, 1, 10, 11, and then also 1.14 through 17, the point of this was not to go after agents. Some of you may have gotten an email today from some agents saying, you know, leave us alone, this is terrible, it's the worst thing in the whole world. We're not going after agents. Yeah, a few. And so this language gets at that. And then on line 1.12, it's just a technical issue. I appreciate Mr. Pender raising. It notes that you're liable to the injured party, not just liable to the whole world or to the public good or something. It's actually to the injured homeowner or the injured person in the car accident. So it sort of cleans up the bill, takes into account some of the comments that I heard. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate support. I believe that there are a couple people that would like to be heard. There is one lingering issue that I expect to address before we get to the next committee. I think we've already addressed it in the language, but if there needs to be more discussion about it, we're going to try to get there. Some of the health insurance companies are concerned that this will get after them. That wasn't my intent when we drafted up the bill. They just brought me language a couple hours ago that I am shopping around to the different cooks and brewers that are working on this bill and have for a few months. It's a single sentence. I've spread that around. I expect that we will address that issue in some fashion before we get to the next committee. And I hope that gives them enough comfort today. I look forward to working with them on that issue because that is something that we definitely want to address before we get too much further along. With that, I'd appreciate support and would stand for any questions or concerns.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. It looks like we have a question before we go out to the crowd here. Representative Paulson?
Just a quick question. Representative Atkins, how come this bill didn't go to the labor division or the consumer labor division? Because you talked about consumer protection. I'm just curious. Was there a reason? Or
Chair Atkins?
Start out there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, primarily because it deals with insurance issues, and that's generally... what we've tried to do in the division is give on issues which is mostly related to consumer protection or labor. They'll get their most significant hearing in that division. Insurance-related stuff is going to get its most significant hearing here, and that's why we're sitting here before you.
Representative Paulson, is that covered? Okay, so... Yes, sir. Chair Atkins, do you... looks like we have Mark Streed. I'd like to come forward and testify from... Are you... Welcome, Mr. Streed. Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Streed. I'm a lawyer at Mesh, Fesher & Spence for 21 years, and I'm a legislative chair for the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association. Here just to make a few comments Chairman Atkins has talked about, first of all, on the direct action. Having tried cases here in the state of Minnesota and the state of Wisconsin for many years, the reality is in a negligence lawsuit, the actionable person in Minnesota, the only actionable person that you can name as a defendant is the individual. They are the ones that allegedly made the mistake or what that's the case is against, but behind the scenes, calling the shots always is the insurance company. And in Minnesota, jurors are not told anything about that. They don't know that there's insurance. They're not told about insurance. They don't know where the money's coming from. Yet the insurance company is definitely a party in interest in the lawsuit. In fact, perhaps the biggest party in interest. And they are not allowed to be named or even mentioned at any point in the lawsuit. Wisconsin, on the other hand, does allow that. And it certainly takes out speculation, head-scratching, and unnecessary discussion amongst jurors about what's really going on here when they see an individual named defendant, but they don't see anything about insurance. The reasonable assumption that they would make is it's coming from poor grandma or the girl next door who happened to make a mistake that's named as the defendant. So it's putting the cards on the table, full disclosure, letting the people that are deciding the case know everything to help them make the final decision on what's the right thing to do on, in that particular case. Good faith. I know there's several folks here from the insurance industry, and for the most part in my career, while I don't always agree with their analysis, for the most part, they, when they take a position, they've got a logical, debatable, reasonable position, and that's fine. That's what disputes are about, what they've always been in this country. There's two sides to a coin. You present your evidence, and a jury or a judge decides. That's a reasonable basis. Unfortunately, and contrary to what some people might think of lawyers, really what we are at heart and what we do as a job is try to solve people's problems, as do you on your constituents' behalf. And some of the most difficult calls that we get are from the folks who are desperate. They're out of their home, whether it's a fire or a roof that's come off through a storm, or they've been in a bad car accident, and they're not getting responses from their insurance companies. And I'll tell you, it does not happen all that often. But when it does, and you hear the desperation in their voice when they are at wit's end, and you ask them, have you cooperated with your insurance company? Yes. Have you given them everything that they've asked you? Yes, I have. And they're not getting any response, and they're not being given any reasonable basis for why their claim isn't being paid, while their roof isn't being fixed or their house being restored, their wage loss not being paid. And you say, well, we can help that. We can help you. Well, how can you help us? Well, we can start a lawsuit against your insurance company to try to get them to pay. Well, how long will that take? Well, honest answer is 1 to 2 years. Well, I can't wait that long. How do I pay for it? How do I pay for you? Well, pay us by hourly rate or a contingent fee. You mean, didn't you tell me that my claim is worth what my policy provides, but you're saying that I would have to pay some of that if we were successful to you? And these folks are at the end of their wit's end. They have nothing to go. And unfortunately, the few times that these occurrences do happen, whether there is no reasonable basis for the denial, delay of the claim.
Mr. Street, I don't want to be rude, but we have to let regions tonight, so just going to hear from the other side as well. So please, if you can help move us along. I mean, in a reasonable reason.
Thank you.
You're probably there.
I'm just about there.
Thank you.
And thank you for that. And unfortunately, the way the current law is set up, yes, they can bring a lawsuit against their insurer, but there are no additional teeth that they can resort to be compensated, A, for their attorney having to pursue the claim, and the Fair Claims Practices Act that is on the books does outline what the duties are. And unfortunately, there is no private cause of action. And what this statute provides is a private cause of action in those fairly rare, fortunately, occurrences where the insurance company does not exercise good faith. Fortunately, for the most part, good faith is the way things are handled. But there are those constituents, those people that don't get that. They need the recourse to be able to hold their carrier responsible. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Street. Any questions for Mr. Street? Representative Simpson?
Thank you. To the testifier, you made one comment that just kind of struck me as kind of ironic, and that being you made the statement that if the jury sees that Grandma is the one that's getting sued, that they will feel bad about this, but it's okay that they're going to see that Grandma's getting sued and insurance company XYZ is getting sued. So then we're going to resolve the case quicker because XYZ is being sued. And as a consumer of XYZ company, am I going to pay the extra dollars because now we have a feel sorry for somebody case? Or help me clarify what you said in that statement.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair,
Representative. What I meant by that comment is if a consumer with horrific injuries, for example, very significant damages, out of work, medical bills, and happened to have been the victim of, say, grandma, who was a very wonderful, nice lady, unlimited means, clearly caused the collision. It's inappropriate for the jury, when they're considering the consumer's damages at the end of the case, to be wondering, gosh, it's grandma. This is going to break. This is going to, how, you know, we should really, and they start compromising because they don't know that there's actually an insurance company behind grandma that will pay if they think, you know, payment is, an award is appropriate. And I think that speculation, the reality is the jury should be entitled to know that, and the consumer, the victim, should not be penalized by that kind of a situation, by not having all the cards on the table.
Thank you. Representative Paulson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Strebel, just to follow up on that, though, I mean, on the flip side, isn't it more likely now that the jury will look at, you know, the bad insurance company as having deep pockets? I mean, is that more, you know, a motive there that could be there? I mean...
Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, Representative, there would be no exposure beyond whatever the carrier did provide, whether it was a $30,000 limit or $50,000. They would never be exposed, assuming they exercise good faith in the process, beyond what their limit is. Having practiced in Wisconsin where there is direct action, anecdotally and personally, I have not seen that kind of a backlash, nor have I heard that from the defense bar who I've litigated with and against. So it's a fair question, but I have not seen or heard any evidence anecdotally or statistically of that happening.
Representative Burns?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to answer... Representative Simpson, Representative Paulson. I have served on a jury in Wisconsin. It was an automobile accident case, and the insurance company was named in the lawsuit. And I sat in a jury room where the lawyers were not present, of course. And that particular issue came up directly. People on the jury said, it's only the insurance company, they got money. So that's one anecdotal or direct experience on my part.
Thank you. Chair Atkins?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, Representative Burns, to that point. First off, you know you live in Minnesota, right? You're not supposed to be on Wisconsin juries, but setting that aside, and I appreciate the anecdote, and on that instance, maybe it did come into play, but if you look at Wisconsin jury verdicts, I think the other place where this is in place is in North Dakota. You don't see that. There really is not a difference, and if you talk to practitioners, and I think even the insurance companies, if they're being honest with you, will tell you, they haven't seen a difference that it makes. What it does, though, is it sort of cleans up that mess where you got mom and grandma, or son, and then it's explained, they recognize it's coverage dispute, they move on and deal with that, with what the dispute is. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Atkins, and Mr. Streed. I'd like to call forward Mr. Thomas. And I was in another committee where I heard this, and so unfortunately your group was described as the bad faith, I think, side, or was that how that went, or... Which wasn't really fair. But,
Mr. Chairman, my name is Richard Thomas. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I'm the co-chair of its Law Improvement Committee and a former president. A few things were said about me there, but someone told me if you're going to be a lawyer, you have to have a hide like an alligator, and we'll proceed accordingly. I think the questions on the bad faith bill, or I'm sorry, on the direct action statute are appropriate. I don't mean to contradict Representative Atkins, but North Dakota is not a direct action state. There are two. Wisconsin is one, and Louisiana is the other. There are only two. And there are 48 other states that have said that don't do it. And they don't do it for very good reason. The insurance company plays no role in terms of the tort committed. Simply put, the insurance company didn't drive the car, didn't run the red light, and didn't cause the damages. For years and years in this state, the mention of insurance was grounds for a mistrial. It's grounds today. If I was in a trial today and I brought up to the jury that the XYZ insurance company is involved, the court would grant a mistrial. And they do that for a very specific reason. It is prejudicial to the administration of justice by telling people what the effect of their decisions are and who's going to pay the freight. In terms of this honesty business, there's all kinds of things we don't tell the jury that Representative Adkins would agree should never be told. We don't tell the jury in a personal injury action that what is awarded is not subject to income tax. We don't tell them that. And there's been great objections to telling them that, although it makes the picture clearer. We don't tell them there's been no-fault payments that have already paid for medical bills, although they might find that interesting. We don't tell them that there's life insurance or disability insurance that have already paid some of these damages, because none of that is relevant. What is relevant is who departed from reasonable standards of care, did that cause damage, and what's the extent of that damage. To simply name the insurance company, the only reason for doing it is to depersonalize the lawsuit and make it easier for recoveries. And that, members of this committee, is doing nothing less than lifting the blindfold from the statue of justice. And it's there for a reason. It's there to avoid prejudice. It would be strange indeed to legislate prejudice, to actually make it a part, legislatively, of a procedure when it is unnecessary, irrelevant, and potentially damaging. Now, the bad faith side of this thing is equally interesting. And I want you to appreciate the scope of what you're being asked to do here today. Minnesota is one of only a few states that does not have a bad faith claim in first party coverage situations. That's true. Most states do. Minnesota, however, does have bad faith claims in third party liability situations. That is, where the carrier doesn't settle the case within the policy limits and does so putting its own interests ahead of the interests of its insured. When it does that, it is liable for the entire award. Now, what this bill does is it takes that situation and gives the attorneys their attorney's fees for bringing a cause of action that is already available in Minnesota and for no reason. There is no reason to award attorney's fees in a third-party bad faith claim. This bill does that. It also takes and puts us it doesn't just put us in line with other states, it puts us to the front of other states. I'm not aware of one other state that has both direct action and a bad faith bill that will allow the recovery of attorney's fees under any circumstance where an insured feels that the claim was not handled expeditiously and gives attorney's fees for that claim. You are creating an industry here. I don't think you want to do it because, as you've been hearing from the witnesses, this isn't a problem. All of the things that people complain about are currently against the law under Minnesota's Unfair Claims Practices Act. And you can report that to the insurance commissioner, and the insurance commissioner will take action, and the insurers are fined. The only difference is no attorney's fees are generated, and the money doesn't go to the person. But the behavior is taken care of. We don't have a problem here. This bill is a radical departure from the law of all states, and we'd ask that you reject it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative Anderson, is it possible, do you want to ask questions now, or can we wait till...
I was hoping to catch Mr. Thomas before he left.
Okay.
Happy to return, Chair.
Go ahead, because we're going to try and, I want to hear from Mr. Johnson, too, and...
It'll be very
quick. Okay, go ahead. Representative Anderson, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Thomas, I was wondering if you have statistics from Wisconsin and Louisiana that show a comparison from prior to them having this in place, what the settlement have been, if there's been a significant increase or what the increases have been. If that's something not today, you don't have to give that, if you can get that to me at some point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson,
Mr. Thomas.
I cannot give that to you today because I don't have it in my pocket, but if we can find those statistics, I'll provide them to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. You were correct. That was very quick. Representative Burns, do you have a...
I have one for Mr. Thomas, if the chair would allow.
Happy to return.
Still happy to return.
Yeah. My question, I'll try to keep it real quick, and hopefully the answer can be quick, too. I've written an editorial in one of the papers about our court system not getting adequate funding and there being a line at the courthouse door for people to get justice. Do you think that inclusion of a bad faith claim would increase the time it takes to settle a case and therefore increase to that backlog for people to get justice out of our court system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Thomas?
When I said that this was going to create a new industry, I wasn't kidding about that. I do think there is going to be a whole new line of cases that are going to be brought, and it is going to put a significant strain on the courts to do that. There is, if you create a cause of action and you give to those litigants who are upset their attorney's fees if they succeed, and the only threshold one has to achieve is to convince six or seven people that the insurer acted unreasonably in delaying a transaction. That's a fairly easy thing to establish, and you get your attorney's fees. It could be a remarkable change in this state for the worse.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Burns, and I will be brief as well. The point is to reduce the number of lawsuits and pull them along more expeditiously. And if you eliminate unreasonable delay and unreasonable denial, you'll eliminate lawsuits, not create more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Burns.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Johnson, we're also going to hear from Mr. Marsh here on deck. So, Mr. Johnson, could you... Welcome. Please state your name and for the record, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, you're receiving here just a handout. And I'll be brief, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman. I know there's hockey and regents and other things going on that people are more interested in, so me too. But briefly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is a significant bill that, if we are right, is going to affect the pocketbook of a whole lot of Minnesotans and the premiums they pay for their auto, their homeowners, as it's drafted, their health insurance, businesses, their liability, their property, significantly affect it and increase it, if we're right. Chairman Atkins is right, and there's a minuscule percent of claims that are impacted, then he's right. We think we're correct. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, is just highlight briefly here what you've received. One is just a handout off of the California court system website that a few years back, when they adopted the kind of lawsuit that's involved in this bill, quantified the fiscal impact on the California courts of $25 million because of the dramatic increase in civil litigation, as Mr. Thomas talked about the increase. We call this bill, and the literature, by the way, I know that Chairman Atkins is saying it's good faith practices. The academic and the legal literature all refers to these as bad faith lawsuits. You'll see it in the fiscal summary here. And we call it also the second lawsuit bill. There's already one lawsuit. This is an additional lawsuit if there is this action for bad faith. So here's the case. There's numbers from the California court system, a $25 million increase. I know it's a bigger state, but the numbers are back in that point in time. If there's a lot more litigation, there's a lot more costs in the court system, and they quantify some numbers there. The second handout, Mr. Chairman, and I'll walk through it quickly. This is actually relevant history on this exact bill. I just thought the committee would find it relevant here. The first one is a letter that Attorney General Skip Humphrey wrote to me back in 1997 when our industry was working with his office and creating an insurance fraud unit, which we did do working with him in the Attorney General's office to fight insurance fraud, and he quantified the impact on every Minnesotan family of insurance fraud of $1,000 a year in costs out of their pockets because of fraud. That's a lot of money. So that was his number. He was on the National Board of an Insurance Fraud Group. in really committing here to say we have to fight the crime of insurance fraud. We agree, and frankly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we think, and I know it's not the intent, that this bill is going to diminish that fight by adding additional, frankly, the cost, the attorney's fees, the extra lawsuit that comes up if the insurer delays or denies the payment of a claim. And I'll come back to that. But then underneath that, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I just thought you'd find it interesting. And here's the testimony or a list of witnesses in 1995. Senator John Hottinger chaired. And this actually, there were preceding hearings that I could similarly show you this list. On bills to create this is not the first time. In fact, there's three times in the last 20 years. I was at all three hearings. Nine individuals testified, three businesses, five people, or whatever, eight, all denied fire insurance claims. All denied fire insurance claims. All of them were investigated by the state fire marshal. And flip to the next page. Just to give a flavor, and I could have showed you the witnesses and what happened at the preceding legislative debates when this bill was rejected. It was rejected by the legislature. One of the individuals, a bowling alley owner, later that year was criminally convicted of arson and defrauding the insurer, sent to jail. And he was weeping, not in this room, but in upper floor.
Mr. Johnson, you're cutting into Mr. Marsh's time.
All right. Underneath that is a Hennepin County jury verdict form for another bowling alley owner, total of fire loss that the jury found. He deliberately set the fire. So, of course, he shouldn't profit from that. And so my point is this, Mr. Chairman, insurance fraud, the need to fight these cases. And underneath that is just a copy of our Claims Settlement Practices Act. Very comprehensive consumer protection laws to make sure that consumers get their money, which laws were written by former Commissioner of Commerce Mike Hatch. He wrote these laws. We were at the table when he wrote them. Punishable by fines of up to $10,000 for each violation of the Act, which money then goes into the general revenue. And the Act is used, and you could find the numbers here. I don't have them today from the Commerce Department about that. So, Mr. Chairman, from our perspective, we have a remedy. We don't need this. The bar to get into this lawsuit is way too low. Chairman Atkins is absolutely right. There's 46 states that have some form of remedy. But I really challenge the committee, and I'm going forward, we need to look at what the courts have said the consumer has to show to file this lawsuit. It's not a negligence standard. The words you will find without exception are words like affirmative misconduct, intentionally denies, conscious and deliberate act, reckless disregard, vexatious delay. Those are the bars, and that, Mr. Chairman, if the insurer does that, then they get sued for this lawsuit, not on a negligence standard. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for those reasons, we oppose the bill and believe that the remedies in place today do serve consumers of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Marsh, you're down to a few seconds. No, you got a couple minutes. Please help us. Please introduce yourself and welcome
Marcus
to the committee.
Marsh with the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutuals, and I want to make sure I emphasize the fact that, especially with the legislation passed last year in second-class cities, we're much more in greater Minnesota in coming into the suburbs than just thinking of us as folks that are insuring farms and out in the countryside, though that's our forte. I want to, pardon me, mention a couple things. First of all, what's being passed out is from our legal counsel, who's worked exclusively in the insurance area for many years and has represented a variety of our companies. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. But I want to make sure that people understand that for us, we're Minnesota only. And any action you do here, we're strictly Minnesota companies. And we think there's an oranges and apples comparison being made. When you hear 46 states with some sort of bad faith or good faith or whatever, the real issue, when you look at the sheet that's being passed out from our legal counsel, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll be the first non-lawyer addressing the committee today. The direct action we are deathly afraid of. Two states, Wisconsin and Louisiana, have been discussed, are the only two states that have a direct action. And the aspect that was talked about in a previous committee, and I think was mentioned by Chairman Atkins, mentioned a homeowner's policy and mold. That kind of an example, again, is kind of about oranges and apples, because if a toilet overflows or water pipes break, those are covered perils. But because a contractor built a house and didn't properly vent it, and years later there's mold, you're talking about some sort of a policy that would be a maintenance policy. That same kind of policy then should be able to pay for paint or redecorating or new siding because you're tired of the old. So there's an apple and oranges comparison, folks, that are going on that is, I think, a confusion. And the bottom line that I just want to leave, and again, I'm going to be brief,
this is
the direct action. How in the world are we going to price something to cover apparel that isn't named in the policy? It's impossible. It's a shot in the dark. It's an absolute shot in the dark. I mean, until you get your self in the red, or the reinsurer is charging you through the nose, it's an impossibility. So what you're asking is price a product, but we don't know what the result is going to be. And the last comment, just if you look at the second page of my handout, the Unfair Claims Practices Act. I can tell you from many trips over to the Department of Commerce, regardless of who has been commissioner, who has been governor, we get called on the carpet. And if we've made an error, we obviously try to fix it, and there's a big hammer to fix it. We don't get called very often, but that's a big hammer. And so we don't think there's a problem. We think this is going to put our companies in great jeopardy, and the bottom line is, there's going to be major premium increases to cover something like this when you don't know what you're pricing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mars, and thank you for not bringing up the hockey tournament. My Hill Murray just lost a couple minutes ago.
Just to Mr. Mars.
I'm sorry. Don't run too far. We have a question from Representative Zellers. There's one more gentleman that wants to come up and say, he said he can do it all in 15 seconds. So.
This is just to Mr. Marsh. You said that you would be asked to write in there, and not to put you on the spot too much, but are you going to, when you ballpark that number, estimate too low so you lose money, or would you estimate in the middle or higher so that you make sure and keep yourself above water?
You know,
Mr. Marsh?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what our companies would do. Because of course, being mutuals, there's the policy owners own the company, and there's not that much above what we think is going to be a break even. I mean, this is going to be one of those things where you could easily get caught in a very serious financial situation in a short time frame. So I would guess they're going to have to try to err on the high side right off the bat.
Well, Mr. Chair, I compliment Mr. March for not being an attorney. You did a pretty good impression there.
Okay, thank you.
That's not difficult.
Please come forward and please say your name for the record, and please be brief.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sillum with the Minnesota Association of Townships, and I will be extremely brief. First of all, I'll apologize to Representative Atkins for not being able to speak with him prior to the hearing. We did speak with Joel Carlson from the Trial Lawyers Association, and I expressed some concerns. Originally, this bill was under our radar. We didn't think it applied to us. In our conversations with Mr. Carlson, we understand that our self-insured government pools are not the intended targets, but it just recently came to light that there's some ambiguity to that effect. And so if we have the assurance of the author and the sponsors that we can work on clarifying that ambiguity, we'll take care of that in the next committee.
Thank you very much. We have.
I think he wants me to. No, we're looking to put it to you. No, we'll look at that. I wasn't aware that was an issue, and be happy to work with you on it.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have a question up here, I believe. Representative Paulson, when he's ready. I don't know if you're good. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions from the committee?
I just have one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chairman Adkins. We danced around a little bit, but say there are some you know, less than reputable attorneys like yourself, a reputable attorney, but less than reputable. So. I said you were reputable. I said you were reputable, but what about some that maybe say left this body for a lower body that would go out there fishing for some of these? And we talked about it, but I mean, honestly, wouldn't there? And I was glad to hear that you're my guardian angel. I just can't figure out where all those bad lawyer jokes came from. But aren't there going to be a lot of folks out there? I mean, they're going to be out there lawsuit shopping.
Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative,
I'm curious for your answer as well.
Frankly, the non-reputable lawyers that are out there, they got lots of opportunities. You can sue anybody for anything all the time, anytime you want. Now, that said, the standard here is that the only time that you can prevail is if there's been an unreasonable delay or unreasonable denial. If that doesn't occur, you're not going to be successful. Present that claim all you want to, but if you can't win, you're not going to get any fees, you're not going to get any costs. It's not a real wise thing to pursue.
The only other question I had, Mr. Chairman and Chair Atkins, on page 3 of the bill, in section 4, there's an open dollar amount there on line 3-5. I just was curious. I mean, I know you got one more committee left, and I was just curious if you're going to plop a number in there after or before.
Chair Atkins, it's on his way to a finance committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, great point. We are awaiting the fiscal note. We don't think it'll be very substantial, but that's the point of it, is to have that plugged in by the time we get to the finance committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The almost final word goes to Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Atkins, I just have to ask a question because I see it as, I believe they said there's two states that already have this in play. Do we have a problem, or are we creating a problem? I mean, is this happening on a weekly basis, a monthly basis? Do we have a backlog of incidences that we can say this is really a problem? I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't see that. So, could you give me some help here,
Chair Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simpson, I know I've seen it firsthand. It's kind of anecdotal, like Mr. Burns has said, but I've also heard testimony from, there was Mr. Galimo that was here the other day. As soon as that testimony, by the way, I didn't know we were on Channel 11 the other day, but it went out on Channel 11. I got just a flood of emails from folks that gave me horror stories, particularly in home cases. I thought there might be some injury cases as well. There was a couple of those, but it was primarily people that had just been jerked around trying to get their mold claim paid for. And in many cases, there were a couple that I thought, well, I could see where there would be a denial or a delay as the insurance company looked into it. But there was, yeah, it happens, and it happens in direct action as well, where you've got, you know, mom and dad, and it looks like they just can't stand each other. That's how it's portrayed to be. And, in fact, all it is a coverage dispute. So, again, I just share with you that unless there's an unreasonable delay or denial, these folks aren't going to have any problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Atkins, would you like that to be your final word and renew your motion, sir?
I would. Mr. Chair, I'd renew that House File 1251 be recommended pass and referred on to the Committee on Finance.
Chair Atkins has renewed his motion for House File 1251, and it's to be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Your bill is on its way, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate your time.
Move that committee is adjourned. Thank you very much.